there has been a joke going around the internet that I didn't have on my 2020 bingo card. That is indeed the case, because we have experienced so much turmoil this year between COVID-19, political strife, racial tension, violence, competing authority structures, and even a battle over the soul of our nation, which is forthcoming, it feels like. It feels like this is indeed not hyperbolic to say it's the worst the world has ever been. Maybe it's the end of days, or simply that the world and the nation will never recover from this psychological and social rupture. Is this an epic moment? Well, I'm extremely grateful that today on Theology on Air, we're sitting down with two wonderful Christian historians to talk about what it has been like to live in periods of plague and pandemic and seismic cultural shifts in the past, and to see if we can kind of place our current moment in context, in a much larger context, and glean some wisdom from the ages that came before. And I think we'll finish with hope and some comfort for what those of us in 2020 and into 2021 might have some seasons of refreshment and encouraging against this dark backdrop. Well, we are grateful that you're here on our Theology on Air podcast. This is a ministry that functions alongside our Theology on Tap local gatherings. This is kind of an occasion for us to take a lot of what we talk about there and interview a more diverse and wise array of speakers and guests. And we get a little bit more time on these podcast contents than we do in person. So I'm really grateful. Dr. Amy Newhouse is with us. She has a master's from Wheaton College in the history of Christianity and a PhD from the University of Arizona in late medieval and Reformation history. And for those of us that had joined us a couple months back, Amy was kind to share some insights into her field of expertise in the realm of contagion, particularly in kind of early Reformation history. And that was a wonderful episode. So you can certainly go back and find that. Her dissertation, a lot of her expertise and published articles are in the realm of contagion in that Reformation early medieval period. So we'll be glad to hear from her again, and so thankful for her willingness to be here again. And we also have a new guest, Dr. Angelo Bell, is a professor who also has a PhD in American religious history from the University of Missouri. And her primary focus is on apocalyptic beliefs in antebellum denominations and cults. Did I get that right?
That's pretty good.
That's amazing. That is amazingly, wonderfully nuanced. And I think you'll be able to tell from both of them that they can bring some expertise and consideration in some of the plagues and pandemics that are noteworthy from history past. But let's just jump right in. I'm so grateful for both of your willingness to be here this afternoon. And just by way of comparison, I think Amy will be able to handle kind of all of our 16th century bubonic plague in Europe. And she discussed that a little bit with Evan a little bit. And I think Angela will be able to take a little bit more of the recent 1918 kind of Spanish influenza. I feel like that's where the majority of our imaginations go in terms of a point of reference to our modern issues in 2020. But let's take a look back, and maybe Amy, if you want to jump in here first, and then Angela, you can kind of answer to your context. How would you describe kind of a medical understanding and what was taking place in their own diagnosis and prescriptions that were happening early on in that bubonic plague? And now that we've got a couple of other, 100 years under our belt to kind of analyze where they blew it, how did they, where were they misled? And Amy, maybe some of that would be a good place to start in terms of kind of some historical humility given our own context.
Okay. So plague is a bacterial infection. It's a couple of months ago, a couple died of bubonic plague. Yeah. Here in like New Mexico or something like that. It's a bacteria. It germinates in rodents, and then sometimes it'll pass from fleas to people. And from there, it can become different types, including a respiratory type that can transmit easily from person to person, although it's probably mostly still at fleas that we're going around and transmitting from people to people. And so obviously they have no sense of germ theory at all, but they do have what's called a miasma. It's from an old Greek medical soon, that defined it, that basically evil smells, bad smells. Like there's this kind of human realization that if you walk by a corpse, there's something unhealthy happening, you know, or if you have an abscess on your arm or something like that, you know, if you ever walked into a room when someone's sick and you're like, "Woo, we need to change the sheets," you know, right? That's kind of a natural, there's a connection between bad smells and things that are actually unhealthy for us. And so, what they did to combat plague, I mean, it's actually the exact same thing that's going to happen with influenza. It's the exact same thing that happens today with COVID, is we want to keep bodies separated as much as possible, right? Because bodies close together in like a dance or in a marketplace is obviously going to generate these miasmic smells. So it's actually understand bacterial infection at all, and they thought it was these bad smells. But if you look at a lot of what they do as far as air circulation and things like that to combat bad smells, it's actually not bad. You know, having things in the 1918 as well, a lot of open air events and things like that to try to keep, you know, bad smells from being in the confined space. That's kind of their understanding of it. But it really, as much as we want to look back and be like, oh, they didn't know we can cure. And it's true. We can cure plague with a very intense round of antibiotics. I will say, though, I've heard of modern day plague. People are still in the ICU for like 10 days. If you do get the plague, it's still a bad infection, but it's one the antibiotics can cure. And ultimately, we can stop that from spreading from the other types of infection that spread from person to person. So you see, again, a lot of, you know, removal of the sick and a lot of shutting people in to make sure that, oh, you may have touched the sick, so we want to make sure you're kind of quarantined as we would do quarantine. And it makes a lot of sense to how we're responding to COVID. They use a lot of cloths over their faces. They use a lot of pungent smells, like a vinegar cloth. You may have seen those kind of plague doctors that have that long, like bird-like beak, you know, classic, creepy. But something, apparatuses like that, there you could take like a cloth that's been soaked in vinegar, and it's supposed to kind of block out the other smells that could come in. So they do things like that. Ultimately, the only thing that's funny is they tend to like throw out rotten food and things like, because again, it's the smells that they think are causing it. So they'll do weird things with like old clothing or with food and stuff like that, because they think it's the smell and not like any sense of germ theory.
Angela, by the time we get to the influenza a couple hundred years later, do you see those patterns replicating? Do you see a more scientific understanding kind of dealing with that? How do you describe how that's taking place a couple hundred years later?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. They do know germ theory. By the time we get to 1918, it's fairly recent. It's only within the last or so years prior to the flu pandemic. So they do know it's an H1N1 virus, or we know that now. I don't know that they called it that then, but we know now it's an H1N1 virus that attacked the lungs. And so they did know that covering your mouth or sneeze was the right thing to do. They did suggest social distancing. We didn't call it that then, but not to gather in crowds, which didn't work because it mostly spread through the barracks in World War I and through parades for support of the war in major cities. So they did know that it was they did have the germ theory at that point. They did still also, though, talk about bad smells and keeping warm. And so there was a holdover from a lot of those kind of ideas about medicine from the Greeks, which was, you know, thousands of years before. But they did know some scientific. They were on the way. It's the first I've seen it referred to as the first medical. My kitten is behind me. First medical response, or first modern medical response.
That's great. I think you touched on this a little bit in the last episode, Amy, but could you both maybe speak to how the kind of stigmas around either the nature of that transmission? I think, Amy, you mentioned that even in some of those Reformation contexts, there were these kind of...
Bruin, you're freezing a bit.
Okay. There we go. Maybe. Is that better now? Ish?
Yeah. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, better now. So can you start that question again?
Sure. I just am curious to maybe to see the modern comparisons of how the stigmas affect kind of the care and concern for those that are infected. You mentioned, Amy, in the last episode of how, you know, these lies get perpetrated about Jews that are poisoning the Christians' water wells, and that's what's leading, that either that's reinforcing persecution that's already taking place or leading to new persecution. So maybe talk more about that, and then I'd love to hear how that also took place kind of in the 1918 influenza.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about diseases is that it travels in communities. And so if you have a community that's somewhat isolated and they really get the disease, come to a lot of conclusions. So for example, in the 1918 influenza, correct me if I'm wrong, Angela, that segregation actually helps out the African American community from it being so widespread in the African American community, but their chance of death if they did contract it was higher based on the fact that they didn't receive the same medical care. So it's in the Jewish community within medieval cities would have functioned somewhat similarly. They had their own kind of areas, even that the concept of the ghetto is what we get kind of first coined in Venice for the kind of Jewish area of the city that they had to close and lock up in certain times because Christians would occasionally get really angry about Jewish people killing Christ and commit crazy violence against them. And they were largely in that context protected by kind of whoever the local leaders were because they needed the Jewish communities because the Jewish communities lent money and were part of kind of a system of business and money lending that in the cities. But occasionally they would just get really angry and purge them. And so this was kind of a normal thing that would happen. So sometimes, at least in the city I study, sometimes the plague was worse in Jewish communities. Sometimes it was not as bad because Jewish communities had a little bit more as far as the cleanliness practices than medieval Europeans. They're not super clean. And so there were times that they were spared. But either way is evidence why the Jewish community is going to be the culprit and why they're going to be the ones that are wrong. And so they're occasionally purged from cities. Cities will just kick them out. And I think actually in the city I study now, they're actually finally the whole Jewish sector of the city was completely torn down and they rebuilt all this stuff on it. And they're finally excavating what was originally torn down. And I even worked with books. I don't know if I said this in the last go around, but Nuremberg, the city I study, exiled its Jewish population in 1496, which was 2 years after a major plague and the year that syphilis broke out as a major plague. And I actually worked with books from 1505 where you could see Hebrew writing in the bindings because they broke apart all the Hebrew books and they reused them to make whatever books that they needed because, you know, paper and animal skin is very expensive for that. So Jewish communities throughout all medieval history end up anything like we're headed to the Crusades. Wait, why are we crusading all the way over there when we could stop on our way in the Rhineland and just murder a bunch of Jewish people, you know? So there was numerous opportunities. Plague was just one new one. I mean, there were especially in the earlier, when bubonic plague first broke out in 1348 to 50, I mean, we're talking a third to a half of the population was decimated. So they're looking for solutions and they're going back to the old solutions that they had as to why their world doesn't work. So there's lots of purgations. Overall, though, plague is interesting in a way, though, because one of the things that happens with leprosy is there's so many instances in the Bible of God like smiting people like King Azariah and then breaking out with leprosy that when someone is leprous, you're like, oh, you, I don't know what you did, but you made God angry and you've got some moral problems. But plague was just such an equalizer in a way, because I mean, it was more likely that poor people got it because they live closer together, but anybody could get it. Major reformers got plague. Their family members died of plague. So it became much more of a, there's communal sin somewhere and God is like punishing all of us. And it's not necessarily if you're sick, you're the one that caused that you had sin. And so that might also cause more scapegoating of taking on the Jewish population.
Yeah. What about the time, Angela, the time we get to 1918, you know, it's referred to as the Spanish influenza in certain contexts. It has other kind of derogatory contexts. How did we get to that place? And how is that kind of scapegoating, stigmatizing happening by that time?
Yeah. Well, a couple of things. First of all, you are correct, Amy, in that they did, there was segregation, especially with African Americans. In particular, the city where I went to school, a friend of mine wrote her master's thesis on the influenza epidemic in Columbia, Missouri, and looked at the African American community. There is still a very distinct African American community in that city. It's about 10,000 or so. And there is a street that borders the north part of downtown, and they built a wall on that street to block the African American community. But like you said, African Americans tended to die in greater numbers because of the lack of care and because of a lack of understanding of medicine at that time, in poverty. As far as why it's called the Spanish influenza, because there is this kind of idea that, you know, maybe it was Spain. They did it to us. What was happening was that we were at war. And so the United States in 1917, April 1917, had to think there for a second. We enter the war, and because of that, there are laws passed, acts enacted that you're not supposed to speak out against the government. You're not supposed to speak out against the war. And it's sedition if you do. And the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act both were very much a way to promote the war and to hinder any sort of dissent about it, because it was an incredibly unpopular war at the time, and becomes so even more unpopular after it's over. And so what's happening is, in the United States, the press is not allowed to report on the flu, and very much the same in a lot of European countries. Spain is not in the war. Spain is not under that same restriction.
They have their own problems, right?
they're dealing with some issues. And so they report it in the press. And because of that, it's given the nickname the Spanish influenza, because they're really the only country that's talking about it in the early stages, in the first kind of wave. There are four waves in the Spanish the influenza pandemic, and they're the only ones talking about it in the first one.
Did you find in any of your research or study that the kind of the pushback to whether it was mask wearing, whether it was social distancing, they might not have used that terminology, whether it was school shutting down and having to do virtual school before there's virtual capacity to do school? You know, I've seen people kind of on both sides of the issue go back to 1918 and say, see, these were contexts and cultures that were much more amenable to standards and protocol. And then people on the other side say, see, there were people back in 1918 that were refusing to wear masks, and we don't need to wear masks. You know, so people seem to be kind of cherry picking to reinforce their already chosen conclusion. But what does your research and kind of history knowledge and awareness suggest the general public's embrace of guidelines and protocol in 1918?
I think, well, the guidelines are very different from local authorities than from the federal government because of the war. For instance, I was laughing with Amy earlier, a couple of days, that there's a social media that has a family in 1918 with masks on, and one of them's holding a cat, and the cat has a mask on. I'm sure many people have seen it, which is hilarious. I think that's fantastic. But as far as the federal response, it is very much, we're in a war and we're going to win the war. And so that information is not being disseminated the way that it maybe would have been during peacetime. So there's not really kind of federal guidance coming down during that time. A lot of it is from local, like cities, mayors, local governments. And for instance, in Philadelphia, one of the earliest major outbreaks of the second wave, which was the deadly kind of deadly wave, was there was this huge Liberty Loan support parade that was going to happen. On September 28th, 1918, I know that date because it's my mother's birthday, not 1918, but 28. She would be very angry if I said that she was that old. But the argument was made by doctors and people from medical colleges that they should not be doing this. You should not be pressing. It was the parade was 2 miles long with hundreds of thousands of people that were there to support it. So you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't be in that close proximity. And other people were saying, you know what? We're at war. And if people cannot support the United States by purchasing a Liberty loan, then you shouldn't be an American. And so it's very much tied up in this kind of idea of patriotism and, you know, we're at war and that's the most important thing right now. So it's a really interesting kind of perspective of who is giving the mandates and who isn't. And so there isn't kind of this widespread attempt to stop people from doing things and get people to wear masks. And so Philadelphia then has a massive outbreak, and other cities who postponed their parades or decided not to do these mass gatherings, they had much greater success at combating the disease.
And they also had more resistance.
Yeah.
Right. That's where you get like the anti-masker movements and stuff is more in like San Francisco and stuff. The cities that did well at shutting down and stopping the virus from spreading.
Well, it's certainly humbling, a little bit humiliating. You know, I'm sure you've seen the like Sturgis, South Dakota outbreak, right? I mean, these are questions that haven't gone away. I think that's a great segue in that it would be hard enough if we just had to untangle a pandemic on its own or a plague or an influenza. And yet, even as you just referenced, the difficulty of tackling influenza in 1918 is that it's tethered to World War I and all these other kind of cultural layers that are making it hard to tackle any of them well. Is there recourse from either Reformation, medieval era, or also, and I'm glad to hear more about the early 20th century, but when all of these issues are conflating and it seems like Armageddon is transpiring, how has, maybe a good way to ask it is, how has the church responded well, and then how has the church responded poorly? Because there's probably plenty of examples of poorly, but I also want to hear some positive ones too.
I mean, I don't know. I don't really want to put them on like what's good and what's bad. I mean, obviously I think the scapegoating stuff is bad.
Yeah.
By the 16th century that I'm really studying, a lot of the Jewish populations have already been purged, and plague becomes, it comes around about every 10 to 12 years. So they've kind of, it's a little bit more of that enemy, you know, and it comes around and you just prepare for it. I mean, the scapegoating stuff does really stop by this time period, at least in large measures. You know, what's interesting about the reformers is they are really amenable to whatever the civic government tells them to do. They're really amenable to listening to, I mean, doctors are barely doctors. Physicians are barely physicians at this time period, but they are medical experts. They are called medical experts in their context. And so, you know, there are these hygiene requirements, and they do them, right? And they abide by those rules, and they shorten church services. And they do still have church services. This is something that's different in 1918, as they full-on stop church services for a while. In the 16th century, you still have church services, you still have communion, but they're creating layers of kind of buffering where people can come. But if you're suspected to be sick, you can come take communion here. And, you know, like, so they're still continuing kind of life, but they're finding ways to do so. They're finding ways that the Gospels almost translated into plague culture, like, and they're not really threatened by that. But this kind of, I mean, this is an extraordinarily cataclysmic time that I'm, if we center around 1527, which is when Luther wrote kind of his famous plague sermon, and that sermon, it's wonderful, you can Google it, whether a Christian should flee from plague, is all about how Christians should step up and serve their community. Because the biggest problem they had, which is, again, different than today, but the biggest problem they had is that all of their city leaders if you were wealthy in that time period, you also were a magistrate. You also had a role in functioning the city. But if you're wealthy in that time and plague is coming, get the heck out of Dodge. And so that was the biggest actual issue, was making sure people weren't just dying on the streets, you know, like they are in Boccaccio's Decameron. Like he describes this kind of death on the streets, and anybody that has resources is gone. And so one of the things that you see with these kind of what they're called magisterial reformers, or Martin Luther, and these people that are working with the cities, is they're saying, hey, a Christian, it's your job to stay, and it's your job to love your neighbor. And if you read Luther's sermon on whether a Christian should flee, it's 100%, but virtually 100% about do what's practical, do what's helpful for plague, take medicines if you want, you know, do your, you know, avoiding of nasty places and stuff like that. Know that your body, if it gets infected, can infect other people. And serve the poor and serve the sick and do your jobs. And if you're not needed to serve the sick, then you can flee. But if you're needed to help anyone, that's what you should be doing. So I kind of lost track of your question entirely. No, I'm sorry. But that's kind of like a positive view of what the church does. And they start to print sermons to kind of console people. In 1918, they're gonna print newspapers, you know, parts of sermons, even hymns that you can like sing with your family at home. So they're going to do a lot of things that kind of help out the plague effort, and they're just going to kind of hunker down, for a while. If that
makes sense. Yeah. Awesome. Dr. Bell, do you think that, I mean, there's certainly probably some similarities in 1918, but how is the church, if you got to zoom in from culture at large to the church, how the church is serving in ways that, maybe imitated the Reformation or broke from tradition? Kind of what's your sense of how churches and communities responded against that outbreak?
Yeah, one thing that is, I think, there are a couple of things, hopefully I'll remember to say them both. One, this is how I do it in class all the time. I'm like, what was I talking about? One of them is that, now I've completely lost my train of thought. one is that, in the United States, we're even during World War I, we're in the middle of the Progressive Era. Depending on who you ask what that is and when it started and when it ended, there's a lot of debate on that. But one of the characteristics of progressives is that they tend to be middle or upper middle class Protestant evangelicals, and their inspiration is to help the poor in particular. They're inspired by what they call moral outrage, all these horrible things that are going on. And so progressives in general were evangelical Christians, and the progressives were very much a part of something called the social gospel movement. So for those of you who don't know, there's the social Darwinism idea, and then there is the gospel of wealth, and then there is the social gospel. And so there's this kind of progression. The easiest way to say it is social Darwinism is in nature versus nurture, nature wins. In gospel of wealth, nurture wins with a little bit of help. And the social gospel is kind of the gospel of wealth on steroids kind of thing. So the idea is that we are supposed to help, we as a community are supposed to help the poor. And doing that, helping the poor and eradicating poverty and eradicating things like prostitution and alcohol and that kind of stuff, that's going to actually create a sinless society, which was the goal of progressives. So there's the shift around the time of World War I, because I spent a lot of time looking at apocalyptic beliefs. There is in the United States in particular, this movement of what we call postmillennialism, which is the idea that, you know, the world's getting better and better and better, and that we as humans are the ones that are helping create that world. And then once the world is perfect and free of sin, then Christ will come back and, you know, we'll have the whole millennium and the happy stuff, right? That's not the technical term, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so the progressives are very much Protestant Christians who are part of that movement. They're trying to get rid of sin. They're trying to eradicate poverty and all these other sins of society because they're trying to get to a perfect world. And so when you get to World War I, there is this kind of significant shift in religious thought. It's part of the shift to modernism in the 1920s, late teens and early 20s. But you have the shift of kind of post-millennial or pre-millennialism, which is the idea that the world is not getting better. It is, we can't solve these problems. The only hope that we have is for Christ to come back and fix it all, because we have messed up so bad, or the world is messed up so bad. We've been trying to get rid of these sins. We can't do it anymore. And therefore, we have a mess. And so there is not any sort of network that we have today. There's no Social Security. There's no unemployment benefits. There's no healthcare, any of that. And so most of the benevolent work that's happening in the United States is happening through churches and charities that are run by churches. So there is very much an attempt to fix those problems. And what we figure out during major crises like World War I and later in 20 years, the Great Depression, is it's just, there's not enough resources that way. And so they're trying, and they're not able to do as much as needs to be done. So, I did say both things. Yay.
So it's just to looking towards the government. Enact reforms to make things better. But ultimately, like, Christians become, there's this idea that we used all of the technology and all that stuff that we thought the world was getting better and better and better and better. And then we used World War I and we ripped ourselves to shreds, and our men come home shell-shocked and they are not okay. And in fact, right after World War I, you get a massive amount of violence that happens as these men come home. They're not okay in the head. There's massive racial violence. The Tulsa massacre happened in 1921, yep. Right? Angela 21. And that was largely returned World War I vets there's a lot of psychological trauma going there. There's a lot of rupture of ideas of, we thought the world was getting better and better and better, and now we need to be at armed guard in our own homes because it's, society is slipping away from us. And America is going towards non-Christian ideas, and we need to be the vanguard of Christianity here in America. But,
yeah, I think that's really helpful.
As the war is ending and the pandemic is raging, there's also, what we call the first Red Scare, which is, the Soviet Union has just become the Soviet Union in 1917. And so we have this sudden, one of President Wilson's ideas was that we're going to fight this war. He tried to keep us out of it. And then once we got in it, he was like, all right, we're going to do this, and we're going to do it to preserve the world. Right. That's the slogan. And so, because at the time when we entered the war, Russia had overthrown the Tsar. Russia is a republic, supposedly, at this point. And then within a few months, it becomes communist. And it's no longer we're no longer on the side of only democracy. And so because the Soviet Union then becomes the Soviet Union, they pull out of the war, leaving the Eastern Front open. And so all the Germans are then able to, and the rest of the Central Powers are able to turn their attention to the Western Front, which is where Americans and British are. And so there's a lot of tension between the United States and the Soviet Union for pulling out. There's more, more death on the Western Front now. And so not only did we now have this new communist country that we have to fight, but we also are mad at them because they made the war worse for us. And so once the war is over, and you now in the United States have massive influx over the last, from basically 1880 to 1910, you have massive millions of immigrants from Eastern and Southern Europe coming in, a lot of Russian Jews, and a lot of Catholics who are coming in from Italy. And so you have this, and Southern Orthodox Christians coming in from Southern Europe too, Southeast Europe too. And so you have this kind of, well, it's their fault because their countries turned communist, so they must be the problem. So you have not only race riots, but you have problems with ethnic groups too. You have a massive influx of immigrants, and they must be the issue.
Let me ask you this. I think that's a wonderful kind of segue, both of you have alluded to, Amy, I remember this from your last podcast as well too, that there's a catastrophization penchant, right? Where each generation thinks they're experiencing the immediate and swift justice of God, and also thinks that this is the end. I mean, that you rightly alluded to the kind of the hole poked in the post-millennial optimism. But what would you also say from a historical context? Because there are people that will say 2020 is the worst year that's ever existed on planet Earth. How do you temper that? Because I don't think that's true. But what would you say both to encourage them from history, from your realm of expertise, and then what might give you some empathy and compassion in our current context?
Okay. I don't know who to go. Well, one of the things that I think is it's hard as a historian to talk about this because, you know, we're at what 190,000 ish people in the U.S. at this point who've passed away from COVID, and 190,000 is a horrific number, and also compared to the loss of World War I, compared to the loss of World War II, it's a pretty tiny number. I mean, when we're talking about 190,000 people compared to a few million, several million, during 1918, it's a much more positive number. I mean, that is something, thank goodness it's not more. Yeah. And at the same time, we're horrified by 190,000, which I think we rightly should be, because I think in one of the positives that has happened is that we've been able to, over the course of the last 100 years, with technology that we have and medical advancements that we have and some sort of things like that, but also just human compassion, we've been able to say, you know, anything is too many. And so there's a little bit of, you know, when you look at mortality rates today, they're much less than they used to be. And so we have this kind of positive instance of it's a lot fewer people, but every one of those people then has people who care about them. And so it doesn't really matter if it's fewer, it's still a horrific loss.
As a historian, I'm sure Angela, you'll relate. We are, whenever people have opinions today, we are always asking why. Like, where did these opinions come from? How are they similar to opinions in the past? Like, how were they constructed? What are the players? Like, often I think people who aren't looking at the historical context, they kind of see themselves as like normal, you know, like that they aren't being contextual at all, that it's like oxygen. You don't notice you're breathing it. You don't notice that you are a product of, and think are a product of a lot of different things that have come in before. And, you know, and for me, it's frustrating because there'll be something new that comes up and goes, oh my gosh, we can't do this. This has never been done before. And we're like, well, at one point the Enlightenment was new and we're like kind of okay with democracy, you know, like, so it's, you know, you're always trying to put everything into a bigger context and ask, why do you believe the things that you believe, you know, where does that come from? How is it specific to your time period? How is it similar, you know? And the reality with the Reformation, and, you know, we, especially in church history and, you know, trained pastorally, I'm sure you know that, like, the church, the Reformation is kind of looked back at as this, like, glorious rebirth of the church and, like, the gospel is for everyone. Ooh, and, like, it was a cataclysmic time. It was a time where authority structures were radically changed. The Reformation leaders did not agree with each other. There was a moment where Zwingli and Luther sat at the same table and Luther like carved, you know, Hocus Meum Corpus, like this is my body, into the table, believing that his interpretation was so clear you could carve it into a table. And they didn't agree with each other. And Zwingli died not that long later on the battlefield, like battling someone else. You know, like they, you know, if you are baptized as an adult now, like they would have you killed for sedition in this time period. You know, in World War I as well, Anabaptists, same lineage of people from the Reformation, were put in Alcatraz for refusing, they're pacifists, they refused to go to war. Yeah. And they died, a lot of them, because of just disease and grossness of being in Alcatraz. So, like, we have to look at this bigger context where, you know, in the Reformation, it feels apocalyptic. There's a peasants' war that happens. Over 100,000 peasants were killed after they believed that God was calling them to throw off the social structures of the world and bring in God's kingdom. There's a number of different, there was Catholic and Lutheran people besiege a city as they were trying to create God's kingdom. It was full of polygamous stuff, and it's very strange. So, like, you get the gospel coming into the world, and people think that the Bible is going to be easy and they're all going to agree, and they don't agree at all. And there's a lot of bloodshed because of that, you know. And over time, you get these particular leaders that stand out that kind of set what's normal. And we look back and we're like, yeah, the Protestant Reformation happened. It was great. But it was really fraught with death and destruction, and it was very apocalyptic. Luther, he wasn't super interested in building church structure for long-term use because he kind of thought, like, hey, it's pretty much the end of days. And they didn't have the same theology as Left Behind and some of this other, you know, even this word rapture really is a 19th century concept. Yeah. They didn't read Revelation as the actual future, but they just read, you know, things that Jesus was saying about, you know, the day will come. And they just assumed they were living at the end of days, and it was very apocalyptic. So in every one of these movements, it's almost like we get a glimpse of what's God's end plan, and we feel that. But ultimately, we're just creatures of a particular context, and this too will most likely pass. And what feels like this is it, this is the thing, people a generation later will look back at our thing and be like, why was that the hill you were going to die on? Like, you know, and so many times a lot of that violence is done from Christian to Christian because they're just so scared. This is what you're going to get, especially in the 1918 context, 1920s, is they're so scared that they're losing this dominance over culture. They're so scared of things changing. They're so scared that they hold on with the widest knuckles. And then over time, we're not as concerned with the questions they were concerned about. So we have to put these things into that bigger context. And that, for me, gives me a lot of comfort. And like Angela says, if we zoom out, we actually have so much more as a way of food, the way of resources, the way of medicine, that we're struggling right now, but we're not dying right now for the most part. There are some people that are, but, like, you know, we aren't. Christian culture isn't dying. The church isn't dying. It lasts through all of this stuff. Yeah. We're just inconvenienced at the moment.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think it's unfortunate that probably us in the West and in those steeped in American exceptionalism so tether Christendom's demise with the end of the global world. As if, you know, if American Christian influence dies, somehow the global church also dies, which is nonsense. I wonder, for both of you, I think you've alluded to this, almost every generation from the church's inception and even across the Old Testament has experienced regular and frequent suffering as a part of their life. I mean, you don't have to go very far. Jesus promises we won't be immune to that. Certainly the first 300 years of the church exponentially increased persecution. And so certainly across global context, that's been true. So even, you know, I remember reading the story of, you know, I think Abraham Lincoln saw what 5 or 6 of his children die in his own lifetime. So suffering has been a part of almost the disciplinary maturation process of the church indefinitely. And yet it seems, both to your point, Amy, and Angela, your point in 1918, that we are post-World War II, maybe even post-Vietnam, or however far you want to go back, this is maybe the first generation that hasn't really experienced a massive degree of suffering on that kind of scale. And it certainly begs the question that maybe we're softer or less resilient or less persevering because of it, where past generations had to allow the suffering in the Reformation and the plague and the influenza, losing multiple family members, having to wrestle with what God was doing. And we just have been so fortunate that we haven't had to experience this until now, that maybe we just were unwilling to learn those lessons. Is that, did you see how suffering sharpened and grew and matured the church in some ways and didn't make them cynical in maybe both those contexts?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of my favorite quotes from Andreas Osiander, who is the reformer for the city of Nuremberg, is, you know, who wouldn't want to be blind for a time if you could face Christ? There's this idea that, you know, Christ is a physician and he is the one who heals, and that, you know, his healing might be physical, but it might not. And ultimately the healing is the healing against sin. The longing that we have for infinite love and infinite connection can only be made in an infinite God. So I definitely think so. I think that one of the things you see when you look at the reformers dealing with plague is there's a lot of fear there, and fear is good. What is it that Angela and I were talking earlier, and she was like, Americans don't really do vulnerability.
Yeah.
This belief that we can be, affected. And if you look at American history, you were saying, you know, since, you know, World War II or since Vietnam, honestly, if you look at American history, most of our wars are not fought in America, the Civil War being the exception, maybe the Revolutionary War, maybe. Like, most of the wars that we fought were always, you know, in Cuba, in Vietnam, or where in Korea, wherever it was. And the same is mostly true for Europe until World War I, which is one of the reasons that they're like, whoa, the greatness of war. And they're like, never mind, war is terrible, let's outlaw war after World War I. Yeah, a bunch of like white dudes get together in a room and are like, let's outlaw war. This is a great idea. But if you look at the world, they are experiencing these things. There were people in Vietnam and Korea and Nicaragua and all of these places in the world that have been experiencing massive amount of suffering. And it feels to me that we're a bit of the rich young ruler, that we are not willing to give up this position of power, this protection that we have being Americans, or being, for me, being a white American. If, you know, if I had to go into a court that had a bias against, you know, for white people, would I still want that? If I was on trial, like, yeah, probably, you know, like, I mean, we have these things that are kind of set up for us. And my fear as a nation is that we have lost the capacity to, or maybe never had really, or for some of us, the capacity to suffer. Mm-hmm. And the capacity to suffer because you are helping somebody else who is suffering, which I think if you drill down to the whole of the gospel, you get to Matthew 25 that talks about, you know, what you did to the least of these, really being the point. Angela?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things, there's a pretty significant transformation going on in American religion during the first half of the, well, all through.
All through the 20th century.
It's really hard to teach American history without teaching religion. Yeah. But one of the things that I think is really fascinating about what's going on with the church, it's hard to talk about the church in America because it's not the church like it is in Europe in the medieval period and the Renaissance period. But the church in the United States is largely Protestant. It is not sponsored by the state. So it is, for the most part, voluntary attendance, and you can choose which denomination you want to go to or not go to or whatever. But we are a Protestant nation. And so Catholicism and Jewish faith is not particularly accepted very well until about the 30s, 1930s, a little bit more then. But not necessarily then either. And there's really not a lot of anything else until much later in the 20th century. So You have the kind of birth of the Pentecostal movement that's going on, charismatic Pentecostal in particular, but charismatic movement in the early 1900s. And you have in the 1920s, right after this is going on with the war, you have the rise of fundamentalism, yeah. The Four Square Gospel and that kind of thing. And so you have that with the onset of radio. You have Amy Simple McPherson and Billy Sunday and all these kind of, you know, radio evangelists who are spreading the fundamentalist faith, while there is with the push to modernism, there's also this kind of shift to religious modernism. So you have these kind of two methods, I guess, of evangelical Christianity or Protestant Christianity happening. And so with the Scopes trial in 1925, you have religious modernism really wins at that point. The fundamentalism kind of retreats. It goes back into its whatever you want to call it, shell or hiding place or whatever. And it really doesn't come back until the 50s. And so you, with Billy Graham, I almost said Billy Sunday. I was like, that's not right. And so then during the 50s, which is because of, you know, a lot because of the Cold War and fighting communism. And so then we see, you know, fundamentalism really win with the religious right in the 1970s. So you have this kind of, I don't know, roller coaster kind of almost going on with the church in America and World War II, with the Holocaust and what's going on in Europe, then there is a significant push by Americans to accept Jews as, you know, the Judeo-Christian faith as opposed to the Christian faith, which is, it's a massive push after World War II. And so you have these kind of shifts that are going on. But I think there's still kind of a division between kind of the religious modernists and the fundamentalists that it's frustrating when I hear the word fundamentalist, because in the 1920s there were, you know, four fundamentals and that's what they believed. And so I have no idea where I was going with this. All of a sudden, I lost my train of thought. Sorry. Anyway, the point is that yes, there is a shift after the influenza pandemic. There's a massive shift after the war, and it's usually in response to what's going on, because you wouldn't really necessarily have an acceptance of the Jewish faith without the Holocaust. You wouldn't necessarily have the triumph of religious modernism without the Scopes trial. You wouldn't necessarily have the rebirth of fundamentalism in the 1950s without the Red Scare, the second Red Scare in the Cold War. So it's fascinating kind of how religion adapts and also kind of clings to these kind of ideas of, you know, God's in control and we're supposed to care about each other and we're supposed to kind of keep doing the right thing. So it's interesting to see how that changes over time.
That's wonderful. I was just thinking about, as you pointed there, even after World War II, you see some of those neo-evangelical movements that start, Harold John Ockingay with World Relief and Compassion International, that come birthed out of that devastation that they all kind of witnessed and trying to wrestle with their convictions and apply that. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. There is a rebound in response to that pattern. I feel like we could have you both on here for another hour or part two. I'm certainly hoping we won't have another pandemic that would necessitate your expertise. However, I do think both of you have given us some really helpful context. I've certainly learned a lot about how to probably neither make our moment catastrophic and the worst moment, nor downplay the plight and mistakes that certainly the church has incurred and been guilty of, and we can certainly learn from as a corrective. So thank you both for your time. It really is, will be meaningful for our folks. Real quickly before we leave, Dr. Bell, anything in terms of where people can kind of find out more about you or where they can learn more history from you directly?
Oh my. I'm trying to think. Amy and I both teach at Lone Star College. We're doing virtual classes. If you want to join us, that's
So many virtual classes, guys. A quick online class for a nice overview of American history. We just churn those out. In fact, if you want them, I can just send you my lectures. I've got videos. If you're super, super interested in that.
Yeah, and it's always fun to talk. It's always fun to talk history and religion. Not too many people want to listen when I start.
I do
have someone listen.
I do think that people, like, one of the things, there's been a lot of different political reevaluations that have been happening, both in the evangelical culture and the kind of culture of American and a lot of people are reassessing history, and they're like, well, I didn't get, you know, the Tulsa race massacre in my history books, and I didn't get this, and I didn't get this. This is a great time to reach out back to, like, the community college 101 classes, because, you know, if you don't know about the, you know, Bracero Project, if you don't know about these things, like, there's so much more out there that if you took a history class in, you know, in 1992, that there's just different, we just evaluate different things and bring in different, you know, what's going on about gender right now, what's going on about, you know, that might be kind of refreshing. So Lone Star College.
Yes. Yay. And amen to that. You heard it here first. Lone Star College for the win. Send all your tuition to help Dr. Bell and Dr. Newhouse ad infinitum. Well, thank you both. Amen. Thank you. Well, thank you both for your time. Y'all are amazing, and hopefully we will check back in with you soon.
Great. Thanks.